Today is Tuesday, November 5th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, House Democrats are preparing to release more transcripts from their closed-door impeachment inquiry hearings. We take a look at how that's been released and shaped the political landscape. Also ahead, Iran's president announced Tehran will start using new centrifuges, but added,
Rouhani said in his televised address Tuesday that all the steps Iran has taken so far are reversible if the other parties to the nuclear deal uphold their commitments to provide Iran with relief from economic sanctions.
Those stories and more are coming up next. House investigators are scheduled to release more impeachment interview transcripts today after giving the first inside look at the closed hearings. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani starts us off.
Yesterday's release was chilling. A transcript of Marie Yovanovitch recounting the campaign to fire her as the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine, including warnings from Ukrainian officials to watch her back as President Trump and allies push for Ukraine to help them politically. Yovanovitch said she was shocked that in a July call with Ukraine's leader, the president called her bad news and said she's going to go through some things. The president yesterday,
I'm sure she's a very fine woman. I just don't know much about
Today, Democrats plan to release a transcript of European Union Ambassador Gordon Sondland, whom Yovanovitch says urged her to tweet support for the president, telling her, you need to go big or go home. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Now to dive a little deeper into this topic and all things related to the impeachment inquiry and the political landscape here in the United States, we're joined on the phone by Augusta University political science professor Craig Albert. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Craig, I want to begin here with this, and we had the transcripts released yesterday. We're having more released today. What's your impression as to if that's having any kind of effect on the narratives by the Republicans, the White House, and the Democrats?
I think it's having an effect, especially on President Trump's narrative. So this is what's most intriguing for me, is that President Trump and some of the Republicans have said that this hasn't been a very transparent process. And so he's kind of been calling the Democrats out, saying that, you know, nobody knows what's going on. This is all done behind closed doors. And so it's a very savvy political move by the Democrats to release some of these transcripts and show exactly what is going on, what's being said, who's being interviewed, what the witness accounts are of these actions. And so far, based on the transcripts, the Democrats have been doing a great job at positioning a narrative that President Trump is abusing his power, as just shown in that piece you ran, that he might be attempting to bully or intimidate people into getting what he wants, and that could qualify as an abuse of power.
Now, we're supposed to get the testimony from Ambassador Kurt Volker and Ambassador Gordon Sondland today, and we saw a little bit and heard a little bit about what they were testifying behind closed doors. Do you expect more of the same to kind of shape the narratives by the respective political parties in the White House?
Absolutely. I think the Democrats are massaging the message to fit an abuse of power or obstruction of justice perfectly against President Trump. So I think what we'll see released today will go a long ways towards providing more information on that message by the Democrats.
Now, if we take a look at the White House, they came out with refusing additional subpoenas, more people not going to Congress to testify. The Justice Department has come out and said that, you know, a government lawyer needs to be present for executive staff in order for that testimony to be admissible. What do you make of that kind of tactic as it relates to the inquiry?
We're in uncharted territory. So constitutionally, the Constitution itself is very silent on the impeachment process, what exactly needs to occur, how the process works. So it's up for debate precisely how everything needs to occur, what an inquiry actually is. There's debate over whether you need an official inquiry or how the voting process works in an inquiry. So President Trump does have some ground here stating that this is, you know, an unconstitutional process, that it's not working the way it should work. And he has what we call in the Constitution the executive power vesting clause, and that means all executive power is vested in him as the president. And so he is issuing or understanding that as a wide interpretation, meaning that anything that is executive, he has he is in charge of. So he can dictate the policy, who testifies, who doesn't. That's how he and his lawyers are interpreting this issue. Whether that's a right interpretation or not is up for debate, but that seems to be what interpretation he's using, that he has wide and great authority over the executive process.
Here we are, the first Tuesday in November. 1 year from today, the United States will go towards another general election to choose its next president. How do you see what's being released and how the Democrats are conducting the inquiry impacting the political process, whether it be the Democrats in their field or how the Republicans are shoring up around the president as we move into this next election cycle?
I think both sides are playing well to their base. What helps President Trump and what might turn out more Republicans is that he's been saying since day one that the Democrats are out to get him. So for him, this process of impeachment and impeachment inquiry kind of just validate and proves his point, which has been increasing his fundraising donations in the past few weeks. And you can look for him to try to message that over the next 6 to 8 months leading into the election so that he can get those folks who have donated to come out to the polls and help him win the Electoral College again. For the Democrats, they're trying to show that Trump has a history of this type of action of abuse of power and obstruction of justice. So they're going to use this to bolster their candidates in the field as well to say, we have to get rid of President Trump one way or another. So if the impeachment process isn't going to work out, you need to go out and vote for a Democratic candidate so that this abuse of power, if it's not technically an abuse of power, the appearance of the abuse of power doesn't continue under President Trump. So they're appealing to their base just as much as the Republicans are appealing to their base. What's left in between is that independent voter. So like often does for presidential election years, it's going to come down to how the independent voter or the person who doesn't often vote, what they think of this process. And my view on it is that many people are, by the time the election comes around, are going to be tired of the impeachment process if it isn't a settled issue by that time. And so it might dissuade them from voting or participating in the process whatsoever.
Greg Albert is a professor of political science at Augusta University. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
In other impeachment inquiry news, Roger Stone, a longtime Republican provocateur and former confidant of the president, is going on trial over charges related to his alleged efforts to exploit the Russian hacked Hillary Clinton emails for political gain. The trial in Washington promises to revive the specter of special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation as the impeachment inquiry against the president proceeds. Stone's indictment in January was an offshoot of Mueller's investigation. Stone is accused of lying to lawmakers about WikiLeaks, tampering with witnesses, and obstructing a House Intelligence Committee probe into whether the Trump campaign coordinated with Russia to tip the 2016 election. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani announced Tuesday that Iran would begin injecting gas into centrifuges at its Fordo facility, the latest steps that go against what it agreed to do in a 2015 agreement on its nuclear program. VOA's Jeff Custer has that story.
President Rouhani said the injection of uranium gas into 1,044 centrifuges was set to start Wednesday. He said that also beginning Wednesday, the new activity will be under the surveillance of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The text of the nuclear deal that Iran reached with the United States, Britain, China, France, Russia, and Germany called for Iran to convert Fordo into a research facility, while allowing it to spin two of six cascades of centrifuges without uranium. Iran previously went past limits on the amount of enriched uranium it is allowed to stockpile and the level to which it is allowed to enrich uranium. Rouhani said in his televised address Tuesday that all the steps Iran has taken so far are reversible if the other parties to the nuclear deal uphold their commitments to provide Iran with relief from economic sanctions. The announcement came a day after Iran marked the 40th anniversary of the takeover of the U.S. Embassy in Tehran by saying it is speeding up uranium processing. A senior U.S. official said Washington saw it as a continuation of nuclear blackmail and a move that further goes against the 2015 nuclear agreement with world powers. The U.S. official said Tehran is attempting to get the worried European signatories of the nuclear deal, known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Agreement, or JCPOA, to make concessions to Iran. U.S. President Donald Trump was asked later Monday by VOA what should be done about the new advanced centrifuges.
Well, we're looking into that. We'll see.
Ali Akbar Salehi, head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, told state television that Iran is operating the IR-6 centrifuges, which allow the processing of uranium much faster than the IR-1 centrifuges Iran was allowed to use under the JCPOA. Salehi also said Iran is working on the development of even faster centrifuges called the IR-9, which he claimed will work 50 times faster than the IR-1. The U.S. Treasury Department on Monday rolled out new sanctions against Tehran, adding to the more than 1,000 already imposed on Iran's oil exports, its banks, financial transactions, and the military leadership of the Islamic Republic. Among those targeted by the new sanctions are the heads of the Armed Forces General Staff and the Iranian Judiciary, as well as the son and chief of staff of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader. Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Turkey says it has detained the sister of slain Islamic State leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in a raid near the Syrian border of Azaz. Reuters' David Doyle reports.
A senior Turkish official said Razmir Arad was detained in a raid near Azaz. The Turkish-controlled Syrian town is 35 miles from Berisha, where Baghdadi killed himself last month after being cornered in a tunnel by U.S. Special Forces.
Closing up to the compound.
When captured, Arad was accompanied by five children, the source said. She, with her husband and daughter-in-law, are now being interrogated in the hope of gathering a trove of intelligence on the inner workings of Islamic State. Little independent information is available on Baghdadi's sister, and Reuters was not immediately able to verify if the captured woman was her. Islamic State has confirmed her brother's death and vowed revenge against the United States. The group has named Abu Ibrahim al-Hashemi al-Qureshi as Baghdadi's successor.
And that was Reuters reporter David Doyle. And you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The World Health Organization says there have been more measles cases reported in the first 6 months of 2019 than in any year since 2006. Two new and separate studies provide evidence that, along with getting the highly infectious and dangerous disease, the measles virus can also wipe out the immune system's memory. The studies published in the journals Science and Science Immunology suggest the measles virus can destroy 11% to 73% of the antibodies created previously by the immune system to protect against different viral and bacterial infections. This means that immunity we had against diseases such as influenza, herpes virus, to bacteria that cause pneumonia and skin infections would be compromised. Researchers in both studies suggest their findings emphasize the importance of being vaccinated against the measles. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. From taxi drivers to frustrated parents hoping to get their children to school, people in Lebanon have found that protesters' roadblocks have changed their daily lives since the start of the uprising 3 weeks ago to oust the political elite blamed for corruption and poor public services. Lebanese troops deployed Tuesday throughout the country to reopen roads and main thoroughfares closed by anti-government protesters. Dale Gavlik reports.
He expressed care and concern about Hong Kong, especially given the social disturbances that we have seen in the last 5 months. And he expressed support for the various actions taken by the Hong Kong Special.
Sorry about that. We have the wrong audio. We'll get that audio back in just a moment. Elsewhere, Iraqi security forces shot dead at least 13 protesters in the past 24 hours, abandoning weeks of comparative restraint to unleash live gunfire in a bid to crush demonstrations against the political parties that control the government. After eight people were killed during the day on Monday, security forces shot dead at least five others overnight or early on Tuesday, including one killed with live fire at a funeral procession for another who died hours earlier. For more than 260 Iraqis have been killed in demonstrations since the start of October against the government they see as corrupt, beholden to foreign interests. In Asia, Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam said on Tuesday she was saddened by some people being wounded in anti-government protests at the weekend, amid 5 months of sometimes violent unrest in the Chinese-ruled city. Lam discussed the ongoing protests during a recent meeting with Chinese President Xi Jinping.
He expressed care and concern about Hong Kong, especially given the social disturbances that we have seen in the last 5 months. And he expressed support for the various actions taken by the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region government. And we will continue to do so in strict accordance with the principle of one country, two systems, upholding the rule of law and trying to put an end to the violence that we have seen in the last few months.
There have been many injuries in the protests, but no deaths. A 22-year-old student at a Hong Kong university who fell during protests at the weekend was in critical condition, hospital authorities were saying on Tuesday. A man knifed at least two people on Sunday and bit off a part of a politician's ear before being beaten by protesters. A 48-year-old suspect has been charged for wounding. The Hong Kong government also said Tuesday it deeply regrets the involvement of civil servants in protests. Commentary by the ruling Communist Party's People Daily also said Hong Kong civil servants who support the anti-government demonstrations would perish with the rioters. And now we go back to Dale Gavlik, who reports on Lebanese protests.
Even at the best of times, Beirut's traffic-clogged streets can send tempers flaring. But add another element to the mix, such as roadblocks protesters are using to pressure authorities to meet their demands, and you have daily life turned upside down, says Helena Keenan, a Beirut resident and mother of three.
The roadblocks have been one of the main barriers to getting the schools reopened. It seemed that at about 5 or 6 p.m., schools will announce that schools open the next day, and then there'll be a barrage of various Twitter and Facebook posts saying, we need to get to the streets, we need to close roads, we need to protest. And then roads tend to close in the evening, and that kind of gets the moms all worked up. And by late morning, the army has them open again.
Keenan's children and others have lost 12 days of school so far, leaving parents frustrated and concerned about the loss of their children's education. They returned Tuesday because the army insisted on opening the roadways. In Beirut's northern suburb of Zouk Mezbeh, a scuffle broke out when some demonstrators refused to remove their roadblock. The army then forcefully took them from the main highway linking Beirut with northern Lebanon. In other places, military men dressed in fatigues cajoled protesters who moved away peacefully. One taxi driver, George, calls the protests a nice way to pressure the government for change, even with the roadblocks. Another, Mohammed, however, complained that a 15-year-old protester tried to threaten him with a knife when he was stopped at a roadblock. Mohammed says ordinary people are fed up with the rampant corruption. But he fears the pressure now on Lebanon's sectarian governance could erupt again into a civil war. Still, Keenan says the mothers on her school's WhatsApp group are trying to keep a sense of humor. One mother posted her own child's protest, mimicking the real-life human chain that went the entire length of Lebanon as a civics lesson.
Every school tends to have these casual WhatsApp groups, which are initially started as homework groups, but have kind of become protest, revolution, update groups. If a roadblock pops up somewhere, someone will inform. Following the human chain that was made from Tripoli down to Tyre, one girl had lined up all of her stuffed animals going from her bedroom down the hallway and into the living room.
The protesters have demanded an end to traditional sectarian politics and for independent members to form a new government. It is still not clear what shape that will take after Prime Minister Saad Hariri announced his cabinet's resignation late last month. Dale Gavlik for VOA News, Beirut.
Hundreds of people protested in Spain's capital Monday against a court ruling last week that cleared five men of gang raping a 14-year-old girl and instead found them guilty of a lesser charge of sexual abuse. Reuters' Emily Spitchell reports.
Chanting, it's not abuse, it's rape. And I do believe you. Hundreds of people took to the streets of the Spanish capital Monday night to protest a sexual assault ruling. Mostly women gathered in front of the Justice Ministry in Madrid after a court ruling cleared five men of gang raping a 14-year-old girl. Instead, the men were found guilty of the lesser charge of sexual assault. This lawyer wants to see change.
There has to be a change in the law, because I understand that judges, in one way or another, implement the law as it is, and therefore we want a law where only yes is yes, that's super clear.
Barcelona's High Court sentenced the five last Thursday to 10 to 12 years in prison. The court said the 2016 assault was not rape because the victim, who was drunk and unconscious, could neither, quote, agree to nor oppose the sexual relations. A similar ruling in the so-called Wolfpack case sparked mass protests across Spain last year over chauvinism and sexual abuse. It was eventually overturned by the Supreme Court in June. The socialist government has appointed a panel to review the penal code. Many here wearing purple in a nod to other feminist movements.
And that was Reuters reporter Emily Spitchell. At least five members of a family in northern Mexico, including two infants, were killed on Monday in an attack by unknown gunmen. Reuters' Zachary Goldman reports.
Cell phone video shows the smoldering remains of a car where at least five members of a family, including two infants, may have been murdered in northern Mexico. Reuters has been unable to independently verify the footage. The attack on Monday by unknown gunmen is the latest case of grisly violence to hit the country.
This is for the record. Nita and four of my grandchildren are burnt and shot up.
Mexican media reported the victims belonged to the LeBaron family, members of a breakaway Mormon community that settled in Mexico in the 1920s. The victims reportedly include U.S. citizens. Family member Julian LeBaron described the incident as a massacre, adding that some members were burnt alive. The governments of Chihuahua and Sonora states issued a joint statement Monday saying they were investigating the incident.
That was Reuters reporter Zachary Coleman. The New York Times reported on Monday that 71 medical institutions, including some of the most prestigious medical schools in the United States, are now investigating 180 cases involving potential theft of intellectual properties. The Times reporting says almost all of those under investigation are of Chinese descent. European Union Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier on Tuesday drew the battle lines for the upcoming free trade talks with the United Kingdom once it leaves the bloc and warned Britain not to undercut EU standards. Barnier said the trade talks after Britain leaves, as expected, on January 31, 2020, might be as tough as the long-running Brexit divorce negotiations, which have consumed much of the last 3 years. He said whatever trade agreement emerges, it will cost the United Kingdom businesses, since they would now be outside the 28-nation bloc. Yemen's internationally recognized government has signed a power-sharing deal with Yemeni separatists that are backed by the United Arab Emirates. The deal aims to halt months of infighting between the two groups. They are both part of the Saudi Arabia-led coalition that is fighting Yemen's Houthi rebel group. Saudi Arabia state TV broadcast on Tuesday showed the signing ceremony in the Saudi capital of Riyadh. That's where the Yemen's presidents also had been in exile since 2014 when the Houthis took control of the Yemeni's capital. We have this update from Syria. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan called on Tuesday for Russia and the United States to keep their promises to ensure the Syrian Kurdish fighters pull out of the so-called safe zone along Syria's northern border with Turkey. In his weekly speech to the ruling legislators, Erdogan said Syrian Kurdish fighters were still present in some of the border areas in northeastern Syria. That's despite two ceasefire agreements brokered by the United States and Russia that halted Turkey's military offensive to allow Kurdish fighters to pull back from the border. Turkey considers these Kurdish-led forces to be terrorists, but the same fighters had also made up the core of the United States-backed force that battled the Islamic State group. And with that, that'll do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our awesome staff behind the glass, producer Nadia Taha and engineer Rob McLean, And not to mention our managing editor, Paul Alexander, thank you very much for listening today. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news at the VOA News website. And don't forget, with our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.